Well, folks, what's popping? Whew. I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel like the last 6 weeks or so has been a pretty wild ride. Whenever we decided to do a series on addiction, it started off as the small little thing. Really was built around the fact that we just landed a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have that Anna Lemke interview. And I mean, I don't need to fanboy over her anymore. I've made it very, very clear that I'm an absolute fangirl of Anna Lemke and Dopamine Nation and all the kind of content that was shared in that interview and also the book that she wrote. But yeah, that's kind of what started it. You know, I had the opportunity and then I kind of pitched it to Anna as, yeah, you know, would you like to open our super elite exclusive 6-part series on addiction? And she said yes. And I was like, oh, crap. I have to get like my ass in gear here to actually like create a series about addiction then. So, you know, look, we put it out to the community. We put it out to the Producers Club. And we just got these incredible suggestions and names coming through. We, you know, I mean, we've talked to people that I just didn't even dream that we would have on the podcast. You know, we interviewed like pretty much the Ronaldo or the Messi of ice hockey. Guy called Theo Fleury, like Canadian guy. You know, when I started Best of Belfast, like that's not exactly the demographic of guest that I was anticipating. But here he is. Here's a guy, an absolute rock star on the ice, and he comes and plays for the Giants and gets sober. You know, he literally gets sober in Northern Ireland and turns his life around. We had the absolute wonder kid that is Willie G. That's a conversation I think will stay with me for the rest of my life, honestly. Former cocaine addict, one of the most successful tattoo artists on the planet right now, whitehead, proud. And, you know, I love talking to people who are not just creative, but like beyond creative and living that artistic life. And beyond the stuff that Willie shared about addiction, I just find it like such an interesting deep dive into the world of tattoos and why people get tattoos and, you know, why do these people ink themselves with these permanent features that don't go away? And we've done it throughout human history. You know, it's such a strange thing when you think about it, but the way he lays it out, and really when you think about it, it's also a very human thing to do as well. So, yeah, look, Vivian, absolute hero. I mean, did not expect the way that conversation turned out at all. Again, you know, you sign up for a story about addiction and you end up getting like a deep dive into trauma, and I just loved all the weird stuff in that interview too, like Dolly the sheep and talking about cloning and, you know, that little tiny part of Scotland that she grew up in. It's just, I love having a chance to dive into people's worlds. And I mean, this series has just been a wonderful opportunity to do that. Alan from Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just looking through the list here, like incredible stuff. You know, I've never been to an AA meeting. I've been a very curious outsider. I've read a lot of stuff about it. I've listened to a lot of stuff about it. And to have him come and basically like spill the beans on this is what happens in these groups. This is why they work. This is why they're powerful. It's probably not what you think it is. The 12 steps are very surprising, I think, when you look at them. And I really, really enjoyed that opportunity that he provided with us of just even sharing his 40 plus years of sobriety and how AA and that community has been a big part of that. So yeah, look, all that just to say, we have reached the end. The official end, we'll say, because it always happens like this, you know, you're trying to get people and then things fall through, or you get 3 introductions literally right at the end of the series whenever you've already wrapped it and you've scheduled all the other stuff. And I feel like we've only scratched the surface of this. You know, I really would love, and I'm kind of putting this out there to get a few feelers out there as well, would love to really explore some more behavioral addictions. So things like video games, things like pornography, things like gambling, anything that's not necessarily a substance, I'm very, very interested in. And so if you know anybody that has an interesting story, or if you yourself have walked that journey to recovery through a behavioral addiction and feel that urge of responsibility to share your story to help other people that are in your scenario, like, please do reach out, you know, matthew@bestofbelfast.org. And yeah, look, super fun. Really enjoyed the Queen's professors. In some ways, weirdly encouraging to see that there are people with their boots on the ground trying to push forward solutions and really address this issue that's taken the lives of countless people in our country today. You know, sometimes it can kind of sneak up on you where you're like, whoa, like this issue is no joke. And so honestly, bottom of my heart sort of stuff, thank you so much to everyone who made this series possible. Thank you so much for listening and contributing and suggesting people and sending emails and sharing your own stories. Like, I kind of had this feeling before I went into it. Like, you do get a sense sometimes when you create stuff. I just had this feeling. I was like, I think this is going to be the most important thing that we've done so far. And that's definitely been the case. So yeah, going to leave you today with a episode from our new podcast that we launched at the start of the year, Mental Health. Myself and a absolute wizard in the field, a world leading expert on depression, a guy called Steve Allardy. He's got, you know, multi-million views on his TED Talks. He's best-selling books. He's been a professor for, I think, nearly 40 years. Well, he's been in academia for 40 years. I'm not sure you can be a professor as soon as you graduate, but, you know, we'll mythify him a little bit more. He does have a big beard. He's like the Gandalf of mental health. Hey, that's a pretty sick wee rhyme there. You know, I might take that into the wild, actually. The Gandalf of mental health. You got to kind of twist it a wee bit. I'm not exactly Eminem, like B-Rabbit spitting the bars, but you can bend words to your will a little bit. But honestly, and to follow that metaphor all the way through, like, I'm just a Frodo. I've been on my own journey with addiction and depression, as a lot of you know if you've listened to the show for a while. And it's just been beautiful to access this guy's knowledge. That sounds brutal, but it's the absolute truth. You know, I read his book before my daughter was born, and it radically changed my life. And it's amazing to be working with him on this new project. So yeah, look, this is part of our 101 series. The idea is we're basically doing a deep dive into the major mental disorders that affects our world today. So for example, we just released ADHD 101, which was insane. Like, I've never really thought about ADHD or understood what it is or why it happens. And I find it just be absolutely fascinating. So I really recommend checking that out. And we've got the Addiction 101 series, which I'm playing today, obviously. And other ones we've got coming up, we've got Depression 101, we've got Anxiety 101. Down the line, we want to do things like Bipolar 101, Panic Disorder 101, Eating Disorders 101, like, you name it. Like, there's so much unbelievably fascinating content that Steve has in his head that I just cannot wait to interpret and mainline to the masses, as it were. So yeah, look, really hope you enjoy it. If you've listened to any of these episodes before, you'll know that they are incredibly far-reaching. There's a lot of content in here. We keep it light and fun along the way while, as I said earlier, like, discussing just really serious stuff, because, hey, these are serious issues. And I hope that you find it beneficial, whether it's for yourself or for someone in your life that you love. And we always try to make sure that there's lots of kind of practical takeaways from these as well. So yeah, look, that's me. Definitely the longest intro I've done for a while, but I always think it's nice just to touch base with you and kind of fill you in on what's going on. I obviously don't do intros in most of the shows because I appreciate a short intro when I'm listening, and I know you do too. So look, in the spirit of that, I'll get out of the way here and wish you a good rest of your day, whatever you get up to, and look forward to catching you next time for whatever's next. I've got a few ideas of more kind of topics that I really want to explore that have been, what's the right word? My curiosity has been itching around. And as always, there's a bountiful supply of interesting people from this part of the world that we can sit down to talk through some of that stuff. All right, guys, let's do it. Oh, and by the way, I use a fake name in the show. So if you hear Steve referring to me as Hugh, that's what's going on. Bye. So Steve, something I really love that you bring to the table in all this is you kind of have a bit of an obsession with looking at mental health problems through the lens of, like, evolution, natural selection, the ancestral world, hunter-gatherers, all that good stuff. So
yeah, and I love that you use the word obsession because, you know, it kind of seems appropriate for a podcast called Mental Health. So anyway, please continue.
I don't know. Would you call that a Freudian slip? I'm not really au fait with all this sort of language.
Yeah, you're doing outstanding. Please
okay.
continue.
So look, obviously, people have clicked onto this episode. They know what the title is. I just want to kick us off by asking,
why on earth did we as humans evolve to have brains that get so easily addicted to things? Because in my head, I'm like, why didn't this just get naturally selected out like some of the other problems we had? Do you know what I mean?
That is an amazing question. And it turns out to be really hard because, look, addiction researchers have been pondering this thing for decades. Nobody has a definitive answer yet. But we can at least see some of the outline taking shape through what I would say are three key insights. Here we go. Number one, every addictive drug hacks into the exact same motivational reward circuits buried deep in the brain. These are ancient circuits. They run on dopamine. They're modulated by the brain's own opiate system, the brain's cannabis system. These are circuits that are designed to give us a sense of reward, a sense of pleasure when we're doing things that aid our survival, that aid our reproduction, that lead to human flourishing. So what are we talking about? Food, sex, romance, friendship, beauty, achievement, and so on. So these are the circuits designed to motivate us to do all the things that should naturally help us get high on life when we're thriving. But addictive drugs, addictive habits, they've co-opted these circuits. They've hacked into the brain and taken over those circuits. That's number one. Number two, every known culture, including all of the modern Aboriginal groups, the hunter-gatherer groups, these are folks that lived a lot like our Stone Age ancestors did for hundreds of thousands of years. Every culture that anthropologists have ever encountered has discovered some rewarding substances that people ingest, people use to achieve more energy, elevated mood, spiritual transcendence, reduced anxiety, stress relief, pain relief, entertainment, you name it. People all over the planet have always been curious about, like, hey, what are the psychoactive effects of all the things that are in our world?
And I'm sure that they said it just like that back in the Stone Age as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, they were really big on the word psychoactive. So here's the thing, though. These Aboriginal cultures almost always put in place lots of safeguards, including highly controlled, highly limited access. They put in place all these cultural taboos and standards and mores to keep people from becoming addicted. In other words, it's like, yeah, we got these really powerful psychoactive drugs, but we only use them in these settings, with these safeguards, with this context. But the modern world, our world, is filled with ridiculously addictive substances, addictive activities that are all around us, and we often have very few guardrails.
Interesting. So this is a little bit like, I don't know, like a shaman would allow you to drink from the magical cup like once every full moon, rather than like, here's a magical rectangle that you can have in your pocket that can literally feed you any sort of digital drug you want 24/7, and especially if you're trying to go to sleep.
Exactly right. Yeah. And I mean, isn't that fascinating that societies that we think of as somehow less advanced, less culturally evolved, they're often so incredibly wise. They've learned over the millennia, like, hey, we can't just let people have unlimited access to this stuff, or it will take over and consume many lives. And so, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to have the elders, we're going to have the shamans, and they're going to basically tell you when and how and where and why you can use these things. And then finally, we've discovered that several common features of the modern world, of our world, actually push the brain's reward circuits in a direction that makes them way more vulnerable to addiction. So in other words, the brain, as we know, is highly plastic. It's highly responsive to experience. So here's a pithy saying: experience changes the brain. And our experience of the modern world changes the brain in a way that makes it way more likely that it can get hacked into and addicted. So we're going to unpack all these points and a whole lot more in today's episode.
Just before we go forward, like, see that term, I hear people say all the time, like, your brain is plastic and neuroplasticity and things like that. Like, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, so
because I'm like, dude, my brain is definitely not like made of plastic, so like what are they trying to say?
Yeah, I think it has a Latin etymology, plastic from the Latin meaning pliable or malleable. Nice. In other words, it can be changed. And so when we say the brain is neuroplastic, it just means that it's dynamic and responsive. It changes on the basis of what happens to us. Get this. Anytime we learn something new, the brain is literally growing new memories. It's literally growing new little dendritic spiny connections. It's wow. growing little tiny, you know, it's basically like saying, yeah, we're going to now put in place a physical structure to represent the information that you've encountered.
And it goes both ways, which I guess is something that we'll get into today as well. You can spiral up or spiral down, as we've said in other episodes.
Exactly right.
Awesome. So yeah, look, hello, welcome to Mental Health. If you've just jumped in, this is the podcast where we discuss the latest tools, the cutting edge research, and ancient practices to help you take back control of your emotional well-being. My name's Hugh James. I'm a podcaster and a writer from Northern Ireland that's been on a journey towards healing from addiction, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and depression over the last 15 years or so.
And hey, I'm Steve Ilardi, and I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I'm a university professor, and I'm a fellow traveler together with you. Hugh and I believe, we know, that mental health is the single most important foundation for all of us for living our best possible life. So it's our mission every single episode to help you feel more informed, more empowered, more encouraged on your own journey.
Awesome. Yeah, and look, big thanks to all of you who sent feedback in about the ADHD 101 episode. We were really, really excited about that one to go out. And so this is the second feature in the 101 series where Steve and I will basically be taking a deep dive into the most common mental disorders that our world faces today. Along the way, just like you maybe heard in the last two, we want to help lay out what causes the disorders, what is actually going on in our brains, our plastic brains, as I've just learned, when we experience the symptoms of these disorders. And most importantly, my favorite bit, obviously, the practical steps that we can all take to better equip ourselves against these extremely human conditions that have been around since, I guess, humans have been around, and the reality that many of us find ourselves living in. So, Steve, what actually is addiction? So we're talking about addiction. It's in the culture. We all know it. Is there some sort of definition that is legit and tried and tested that you will go to that can set a bit of a context?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't want to do the maneuver, the Supreme Court ruling when asked to define obscenity. You know where I'm going with this?
Not at all, please. I'm not American. Please tell me.
I'm completely bastardizing the quote, but it's something like basically, I can't define it, but you know it when you see it. You'll know it when you see it. I think a lot of people have such an intuitive feel for addiction that they're like, yeah, there's no.
Yeah, and you can kid yourself, but like, you know, like you don't need to see the definition, but like, you know, if it's happening to you deep down, you may need to dig through a couple of layers, but you know, like in your heart of hearts, like whether
Absolutely.
Or not it's happening.
Yeah, but I'm going to give you, having said that, which I think there's a lot of truth to that, I'm going to give you more of a clinical researcher perspective. Here we go. Addiction is what happens when the brain's motivational circuitry, the brain's reward circuitry, gets taken over and co-opted and hacked by a substance or by a habit that is so good at tricking the brain's reward circuitry that's basically like, okay, this drug is now your ultimate reason for living. Mm. This is your highest good. This Wow. is your purpose. This is your meaning. Why? Because why do we have reward circuits in the first place? Why do we have motivation circuits? It's to give us a signal that this is the good life. Keep doing this. This is your highest good. And, you know, that's what we're designed to be doing, is getting high on life, on the things that are good for us and for the people that we care about. And yet a drug can basically just hack right in And some habits can do this as well. And now we have been hijacked, almost like we've been taken over by a parasite. That's addiction.
I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised. I shouldn't be. Like, I've known you long enough to know that every time I talk to you, I learn something new and come at something from a completely different approach. But in that moment when you just said that, it just, like, the penny dropped for me. I was like, oh my goodness. Like, the same reward circuits that are in my brain that are designed to make me be a better father and designed to encourage me to take care of my daughter and to be present with my wife and all these kind of, like, super worthy things just gets completely hijacked, as you said, to do something that maybe seems seemingly stupid, like, I don't know, like playing chess or drinking too much or taking a certain drug or whatever kind of behavioral activity. So that is interesting. Absolutely. Where it completely flips the script and in the process also takes you away from those things that are ultimately valuable and important in your life. And I guess that's the devastating aspect of addiction, isn't it?
Yeah, that's so well put. Okay, so now I'm going to qualify it just a little bit. And I know this is a question that you and I talked about in pre-show, which is like, okay, is this a spectrum, right? Like we talked about last week with ADHD, is it like an all or nothing thing? Like somebody's an addicted, their brain's been hacked and they're like this horrible addict now forever. And I would say clinically, we're really looking for two things with addiction. One is that it is really, as it is hacking the person's brain, it is harming them. It's harming them. It's, you know, whatever it is that they're using, whatever it is they're doing, it's having a really obvious negative impact on their life. Now, that might, you know, seem like, oh, well, of course, anything that's addictive would do that. Turns out, not necessarily. So I'm going to give you an example from my own life. I am a pathetic caffeine junkie.
I thought we were going to get a world exclusive there.
It is, dude. This is like true confessional. I'm pouring my guts out, pouring my heart out to the world. I have just recently measured my daily caffeine consumption.
Oh, no.
And yeah, I dose it. It turns out, who would have ever guessed that I dose it very scientifically, very carefully? 48 ounces per day of drip brewed coffee. Okay, 48 ounces. So I have been telling myself, well, it's 3 cups of coffee a day. These are big ass cups though, right? They're 16 ounce mugs.
Dude, that's 1.3 liters. Sorry, I had to do the search. What the heck? Even like from a pure liquid point of view, that's some serious flow happening.
That's some serious flow. But I know. But here's the deal. Caffeine is for some of us at least, a cognitive performance enhancing agent. It increases mental stamina. It increases focus. It increases alertness. And it's particularly good, I think, for those of us who might have a little bit of ADHD spectrum kinds of phenomena in our lives. It can play the role of a mild stimulant. Mm. And it turns out that there are, and by the way, I have to tell you, what an enormous relief for me as a clinical researcher over the last 20 years to see study after study after study of coffee and caffeine showing, hey, it turns out that up to like, you know, 3, 4, 5 cups a day, we see increased lifespan.
Yeah.
With frequent coffee drinkers. We see that the average American gets more antioxidants daily from coffee than from any other single source. Like, it has lots of potentially beneficial effects. So, you know, but imagine that we woke up tomorrow and there was now absolutely slammed up definitive proof that coffee did to the body what tobacco did.
You know, dude, there's your next screenplay. Come on, you're on a roll.
Oh, absolutely. So imagine that I wake
in
up tomorrow.
A world where caffeine becomes outlawed.
So
one
imagine.
Professor.
Sorry.
No, that's good. Yeah, please continue. So now I'm like, oh, great. I am doing to my body what like smoking two packs of cigarettes a day would be doing, which is to say destroying my vasculature, setting myself up for premature heart attack, stroke, lung cancer, emphysema. I mean, you know, we could go on and on. Now all of a sudden I have to face a choice. I can either keep using knowing that I'm destroying my body, which makes me a diagnosable addict, or I can try to cut out caffeine, which will give me agonizing withdrawal for, you know, 3 to 7 days, mm-hmm. which also now, you know, basically flags me as a potential addict. So I guess, you know, why am I sharing this story? Well, first of all, I'm hoping that probably it's relatable to a lot of our audience. And secondly, to illustrate that addiction is on a spectrum. It's on a continuum. And some of us are addicted to things that technically, yes, we rely on, we have to have it, or at least we think we do, without going into withdrawal. And yet probably not really harming us, might even in some cases be helping us. And so we're not going to actually make a diagnosis. The only thing saving us from the diagnosis is the fact that it's not hurting us.
So this is really fascinating. And actually, I'm really glad you brought caffeine up because it's a useful little kind of nugget to unpack. So my favorite definition of addiction, I obviously come at things from slightly different perspectives than you. I say I underscore the word slightly.
Slightly. Yeah.
My main Hungarian step-in father here in the podcast land, Mr. Gábor Máté, he has a great definition that I love. And off the top of my head, it's something like, you know, you need to have three things under the realm of Gábor Máté in order to be addicted to something. First is it has to be something that gives you short-term pleasure. The second is you have to have the inability to give it up. And the third, to your point, is that it has negative consequences on yourself or the people around you. And I've just found that, yes, it's much broader than the definition that you shared, but I find that to be very, very, very helpful. And to use your caffeine analogy or example, according to his definition, I could be addicted to caffeine if I took it, because caffeine has a terrible, terrible effect on me. I had to cut it out of my diet like 2-3 years ago because the constant high followed by the crash, I just rode those waves really, really heavily. I would get very, very quick and sharp headaches if I missed my dose, even by a couple of hours. And that roller coaster, for other reasons, which we'll go into when we talk about Hamilton in a future episode, I suppose, it's a drug that I've had to stay away from because it takes me higher and lower than it is sensible for me to be in my day-to-day life. So in this paradigm, I was having negative consequences on myself. And thankfully, I was able to walk away from that. If I was not able to walk away from it, then wham, bam, there you go. There's your addiction diagnosis.
Yeah, that's a beautiful illustration of a point that we're going to be coming back to. I'll bet it's going to be like a mantra. If there is a mental health podcast bingo game out there, it's going to be on the card.
It could be our hashtag personalized medicine.
Personalized medicine, man. So what are we talking about? Personalized medicine is just basically the insight that there is no one size fits all effect of anything on anyone, or at least on everyone. And so it turns out that, you know, caffeine really harmful and toxic for some people. Caffeine really pretty helpful and not harmful at all for others.
Totally.
And so we're gonna find a lot of that. Now, you know, then this maybe it kind of, I don't know, are you okay talking about like how we in the clinical realm, how we professionally diagnose addiction?
Please give us your knowledge. We're hungry.
Oh, this is so good. This is so good. Okay, I hope you're sitting down. I can't see you right now, but are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
There is no diagnosis of addiction in our diagnostic Bible, the DSM. DSM has nothing that corresponds to addiction.
I mean, I feel like that's just lazy.
it's just, dude, it is so bonkers. To those of us who've been in the business for a while, and for me, that's like 32 years, I cannot believe it. Okay, so for people keeping score at home, we are now on the fifth, count them five editions of the DSM. DSM-4, the last edition, had a diagnosis. We called it substance dependence, but if you looked at the actual criteria to be diagnosed with dependence, you were an addict, okay? Mm-hmm. So we had a de facto diagnosis of addiction. In their infinite wisdom, the committee for DSM-5 said, hey, you know what? Let's take addiction, substance dependence, and then let's mash it up with just the people that occasionally use too much and get into trouble. Think like, you know, the binge drinker, the binge user, the person who goes on a bender, but like they're not really an addict at all because they might go the next 3 months without doing it again. Let's mash all that into one big super category, which we'll now call, and this is the actual diagnosis in the DSM, substance use disorder. And it gets modified by, you know, whatever the substance happens to be. So it could be alcohol use disorder, cocaine use disorder, et cetera. And now we've got 11 core symptoms that run the gamut from hardcore addiction to occasional problematic binge use. And we just like, if you have two or more of these 11, you get the diagnosis. Dude, you have substance use disorder, but that label tells us almost nothing about whether or not you're an addict.
Interesting. So, I mean, do you have any insight into why they did that? I mean, because part of, I guess, I'm trying to look for the positive here. I'm like, why on earth would they do that? I guess in some ways, you know, the A word does carry an awful lot of stigma. So,
yep.
I was talking to someone recently, locally here, and they were sharing how, you know, in the addiction world, stigma kills, you know, and I was like, well, like, that's a pretty clickbait thing to say. So, like, tell me more. And they were saying, well, you know, like, if addiction is like highly taboo and highly stigmatized, then communities don't want to have addiction treatment facilities in their neighborhoods. You know, they don't want to have things like needle exchanges. They don't want to have drop-in centers for addicts because these are bad people and these people are going to terrorize your neighborhood and so on and so on and so on. And they said, you know, by removing some of that stigma that the addiction word brings, it actually saves lives. But is there anything else going on, or is it kind of a bit of a DSM mystery, as many things are?
Yeah, well, it is a bit of a mystery, but I completely agree with you that I think it was well-intended, and I think there were two intentions behind it. One, as you said, it is somewhat destigmatizing. By the way, they could have just kept substance dependence, which everybody knew was addiction, everybody in the field, you know, all the professionals.
Yeah, so, well, you know, it's also like, who are you kidding? Like, it's not like by deleting the word addiction, it doesn't make it go away. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, a rose by any other name. And but I think the second thing, and this is actually to me kind of hilarious, is they were trying to honor and acknowledge the fact that everything is on a continuum, on a spectrum, just as we've talked about earlier. So they're like, all right, well, you know, there are all these different sort of, it's like a continuum of problematic substance use running from the occasional weekend bender all the way through, like, you know, the hardcore junkie living on the street. So let's just put the 11 most important ways this can happen, the 11 core symptoms, in one big category, and we'll have the diagnostician give a severity specifier. Is it mild, which is just a couple symptoms? Is it moderate, which is like 4 to 5? Or is it severe, 6 or more of the 11? If you're clocking in at, you know, 6, 7, 8 or more, then you're almost certainly an addict. So the field is kind of like sneakily being like, yeah, all right, well, if you're severe, then okay, that's the addict. But it just turns out to be really, really confusing, really, I would say, ultimately counterproductive. But that's where we are.
I don't know why, but it when you were like talking about the thing there, I just pictured like it's like a really depressing BuzzFeed quiz. You know what I mean? Like, take these 11 questions to see if you and your friends are indeed addicted to anything. It's like,
exactly.
Oh. Well, I mean, okay, well, let's go here then. So I don't think we need to spend too much time talking about like the actual impact that addiction has in society. I mean, we mentioned earlier, we all know somebody who at least knows somebody. We all have that member in our family or our community. We all perhaps have been on the spectrum ourselves with some substance or some behavior. And that's what I want to get to. In my opinion, as a millennial or slightly younger, I don't even know what generation I actually am in, it seems to me that there's been a real kind of slow adoption of legitimizing behavioral addictions. So how does the field kind of start to distinguish and think through the substance addictions, which we've kind of covered, with some of the more behavioral addictions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that when you're talking to health professionals, when you're talking to mental health professionals, one of the things that always gets our attention is when something is fatal, when something kills tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people a year, that it just grabs us in a way that really almost nothing else will. And so addiction is incredibly lethal. And just to give listeners a sense of like the crazy increase in addiction-related overdose deaths, in the year 2000, there were an estimated roughly 17,000 overdose deaths in the U.S. Okay, total drug overdose deaths. Most of these were in the context of addiction. 17,000, that's, you know, like roughly half the number killed in motor vehicle accidents. So,
oh my goodness,
a massive societal problem, but one that, you know, we can put in context of other problems. For frame of reference, we have about 45,000 suicide deaths in the U.S. every year. Last year, for the first time in U.S. history, we had over 100,000 overdose deaths.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So a more than five-fold increase in two decades. And so you could take all the suicide deaths, all the homicide deaths, and all the motor vehicle accident deaths in the U.S., add them all together, and it's still lower than the number of drug overdose deaths. So this is a massive societal problem. The number of drug deaths have doubled just in the past 7 years in the U.S. And, you know, we'll unpack some of that a bit later. Obviously, a lot of it has to do with the fact that opiates and synthetic opioids are so potentially deadly because, you know, they're very addictive and they turn off the brain's breathing centers. So when people die, it's usually they've taken just a bit more than they were used to, and they're feeling great while their brain basically turns off their breathing and they die. Wow. They suffocate, but they don't know it. So I know that's a really, you know, horrible sort of thing to ponder and to contemplate, but I think we have to go there right now when we think about substance versus behavioral addictions. Why? Because behavioral addictions like gambling addiction, like gaming addiction, like screen addictions, like sex addiction, they can be really devastating, but they're almost never lethal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
yeah,
so they take us to a different place. They, at least on the clinical hierarchy, it's like, yeah, we don't want to see somebody have their life taken over by this thing. And we definitely want to take it seriously and treat it. But the problem of substance addiction right now, at a societal level, at a public health level, is just overwhelming. And it's kind of swamping a lot of other things in its wake.
So that's actually really helpful. And it actually gives me a lot more empathy for the field, because I am very, very critical of, you know, I look at the things that are really tearing the families in my community apart and destroying even just the mental health of some friends of mine. And a lot of it is behavioral, you know, and particularly throughout COVID, you have just got this crazy rise in gambling addictions, social media addictions, video games, pornography, like name any behavioral addiction that you want. And in an ideal world where you're not dealing with hundreds of thousands of people literally dying in the short term, then you could throw the full weight of the system behind solving some of these behavioral things. And I only just kind of realized that whenever you shared that as with so many kind of things in society, we are just trying to keep our proverbial heads above the water, and we don't even have time to start thinking about life rafts. Do you know what I mean? Never mind.
Absolutely.
Like big systemic change. So that's tough.
That's really well put. I mean, and so the medical term here, when people, and I don't know if they use this in Ireland, I'll bet they do. When you show up at an emergency room, if the ER is really packed, it's like, you know, say it's midnight on Saturday night or something, they have more patients than they can actually deal with right in this moment. And they do something called triage, triage, which is just like, okay, we're going to basically do a quick and dirty assessment of everybody. And we're going to try to put out the fires that are like the five alarm fires. Oh, yeah. This guy just came in with a stab wound and he will literally bleed out in 20 minutes if we don't attend to this. So
We can attend to Hugh's broken nose slightly later on.
Exactly. I was hoping we would go there. So the broken nose is like, we can take care of that. I had horrible food poisoning one time when I was about your age. And, you know, same thing, showed up at the ER. And there were dudes coming in with gunshot wounds. And I mean, it was an inner city Atlanta ER.
Ow, my tummy.
I was lying in a pool of my own vomit. I don't want to, it's TMI already, but it was bad. And they're like, yeah, we'll get you on a gurney eventually. And, it felt like anyway, what's the point? During the pandemic, especially these past 2 years, it has, we know it and we've talked about it. It has posed an unprecedented challenge societally to mental health for all kinds of reasons. And we've kind of been in triage mode in the mental health world. And I'm sure we'll do an episode on this before too long. Every psychotherapist that I know has a wait list right now. Every single one, even the ones that aren't any good, have a wait. And I say that with all due affection and respect. Awesome. But there's a lot of variability in clinical talent and training. They're all full. So behavioral addiction is important, and we're going to talk about it.
I feel like it would be interesting to touch just ever so slightly on the why. And I'm happy to kind of like bust this open a little bit with my own story. To save the full, 2 hour violin story, I guess I fell into the world of addiction, as a lot of people do, as a form of self-medicating,
Absolutely.
We can go into details of the story, I guess, another time. But the long and the short was, had a suicide attempt whenever I was early teens. From that kind of have had a real battle with depression. And when I look back at the things I was addicted to, and they were total behavioral addictions. It was, the typical things of teenage boys. It was video games. It was pornography. But, I was stuck in this vortex for most of my teenage life. And it was really rooted at its core, I believe, in this desire to escape from reality, because my reality was so painful with depression. A lot of undiagnosed things. There was no treatment whatsoever. There was no 6-step program from the depression cure, trademark Steve Ilardi. There was none of that. It was just kind of doing the best. Same with my family. We were all just kind of in the short term trying to get through to the next month. And I think a lot of us will get into addiction as a way to escape pain, as a way to escape our reality. But I wonder, is there anything else in the why behind addiction? I guess this is the segment on the show where it's like, okay, Steve, give me your neuroscience bit. Give me your research. What are some of the causes of addiction? What's going on in the brain? What are some of the things that the studies have been picking up? Give us access to this ivory tower research that lay people like me just cannot sit through and comb through and get the important bits.
I love the way you put that. All right. So I'll try to be as engaging as I can with this. We're going to talk a little bit of genetics, a little bit of neuroscience. So first things first, everybody knows that there are huge genetic differences in people's susceptibility, proneness to becoming an addict. We know that addiction runs in families. We know that genes matter. How much? Well, in the business, we've got a metric. We call it heritability, and it's just a fancy way of trying to put a number on how much of the story of this outcome, how much of that story can we tell just by knowing a person's genetics, okay? So we just put a number on it. It's a percentage from 0 to 100. Heritability of 0, it's nothing to do with genes. Heritability of 80, like we see, say, in schizophrenia, has a lot to do with genes. Well, in addictive disorders, heritability tends to clock in around 50 to 60%. So genes really, really matter. They're not the whole story, but they're you know, a sizable part of the story. So what do the genes do? The genes are the operating system. They're the recipe book for growing the body and the brain in the womb and during development, but they're also the real-time instruction manual, the operating system for every brain cell, every second of our lives. And one of the things that they do when it comes to addiction is they control the function of those motivational circuits that we talked about before. These are the circuits that run on dopamine, which pretty much everybody knows is, you know, it's often talked about as a kind of a feel-good brain chemical or neurotransmitter. I think of it more as a motivational, energizing, rewarding neurotransmitter. It's used in the circuits of the brain that give us our drive to do stuff. Now, those circuits are designed to light up, to get really active and deliver a sense of well-being or reward when we're living the good life, when we're doing things that, at least for our ancestors, would have made them more likely to survive and thrive and flourish and reproduce and be part of the group. And those reward circuits for some people are really, really nicely designed. So they allow us to get high on life. So when we, you know, have a good meal, we get a nice surge of reward. When we hug a friend, big surge of reward. And then other people have circuits that are just very dull and sluggish, so that they kind of go through life feeling like, you know, nothing really gives me much sense of satisfaction.
You know, I actually have a nice little thing that someone shared with me recently on the podcast. They said they were an alcoholic and had 40 years sobriety. And they said before they took their first drink, they felt like life was in black and white. And the second they had that first guzzle, it was as if someone turned all the color on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've had many addicts share with me that the first time they used, it was like, it felt like coming home. Mm. It felt like this sense of, oh, this is what everybody else feels all the time. Like, now the drug is giving me the sense of well-being, the sense of reward, the sense of like, oh, it's all okay. That feeling that everybody else has been describing, now I have it too. Now, here's the super cool discovery. And this is made in part by the work of the director for the National Institute on Drug Abuse, longtime director in the U.S. Her name is Dr. Nora Volkow. She's a clinical research genius. One of the things they've discovered is that there are some dopamine receptors. Basically, these are the docking stations that receive the signal, the message that dopamine is sending in these circuits that kind of regulate. They're, imagine sort of like a set of control switches or dials for like setting up how finely responsive and calibrated is this whole system. We call them D2 receptors. And there's more to the story. This is an oversimplification, but it's a really important part of the story. So D2 receptors, basically in our midbrain reward circuits, they control like how sensitive, how responsive is your reward circuitry. And if you have really high levels of D2 receptors, then you get a lot of reward from all the stuff you're supposed to. You get high on life. If you have low D2 receptors, then you don't. Now, here's the thing. People with high D2 receptors, when they use heroin, when they get drunk, when they, you know, get high on marijuana or, you know, whatever the drug they use, typically their reward circuits respond and they're like, oh, yeah, why? Because every drug of abuse targets these same circuits. So, yeah, they get high, they get reward, but it's kind of comparable to getting high in life. So they use, and then they're like, oh, yeah, that was nice.
So it's like the difference between switching from HD to 4K. You're like, oh, yeah, that was pretty awesome. But like, it's nothing like going from, I don't know, 200. to 1080p. Do you know what I mean? If you're absolutely someone who has that dull receptors, as you said, then it's such a big, significant uplift, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, you're listening to some staticky AM radio feed and like you can just barely make out like, oh, I think that might be my favorite song, but I hear something. It sounds a little bit like music. And now, like, you got the headphones on and you got the $10,000 sound system and it's cranking up at the highest fidelity. And you're like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Now, if you have high D2 receptor density, then if you get high, if you use a drug of abuse or a potentially addictive behavior, for the most part, you're going to be like, yeah, okay, that was fine. What's next? Like, you know, it's like, yeah, I can take it or leave it. It's fine. Like, I have no craving to do it again. It wasn't like coming home. It wasn't like the lights were turned on. It was like, yeah, all right, whatever. If you have low D2 receptors, and especially really low receptors, then it's like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing ever. Your reward circuits are lit up like a Christmas tree. And your brain is now telling you, this is your highest good. This is your, the ancient Romans would say your summum bonum, right? Your highest good, your reason for being. This is what you must pursue for the rest of your life at all costs. And by the way, it doesn't always happen so dramatically. Sometimes it's more of a gradual thing, but typically the idea here is somebody who's set up and vulnerable, they use, and their reward circuits are now allowing them to feel what the rest of us feel. Okay. Now, having said that, let's just backtrack a second and talk about our genetics. What do our genes do? Well, guess what? They genetically predispose us, some of us, to have high D2 receptors so we can get high on life and we're not vulnerable to addiction. Others are genetically disposed to have lower D2 receptors, they're going to be more vulnerable. Now, that sounds like fatalism, sounds like genetic determinism. And I want to reassure people. First, I want to validate, if you have a close relative, genetic relative, who's an addict, you need to be more careful. You absolutely should be more vigilant because there's a good chance that you will have some of their susceptibility. But the brain is neuroplastic and our D2 receptors will regulate themselves up or down based on what we do day to day, moment to moment. In other words, the way we live, what we do will change the brain in such a way that it will make us more or less addiction prone. It's really amazing.
That's crazy. I have a very specific question for you, and it's probably too big for right now, but I just wanted to get out of my head. So, you know, as you say, we all know addiction is genetic and it's kind of passed down from, you know, parent, child. Is there any sort of evidence that shows, say, you come from a long line, say 40 generations of alcoholics, okay? And then let's
40 generations, okay. That's a lot of generations, yeah. Okay.
And then let's say that the next five, they are people who achieve sobriety and stay away from addiction. Is there any sort of benefit genetically that gets passed down, or is it that way too short a time frame for like an evolutionary process like that to take place?
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's too short a time frame for population-based evolution or natural selection. But I mean, there's genetic change in family lineages. Why? Because the genetic deck gets reshuffled between parents with every child. So you could literally have two addicts as parents and they have a child, but the child, on occasion, they'll have a child that will just hit the jackpot genetically, will get all of the non-addictive versions of those various genes and will wind up genetically not vulnerable at all. But on average, if they had 20 kids, you know, a high percentage of them would be very prone to addiction. Doesn't mean they're destined, doesn't mean they're doomed, but it means that they got to be a lot more careful.
Well, then, you know, sure. I'm just, you know, obviously it was a very thinly veiled question. I guess as part of the potential genetic makeup that I will pass down to my kids, I also hope to pass down to them some of the tools and the resources that I've been able to pick up along the journey to help them navigate that world for themselves, which is, it's not genetic, but it is kind of something that is transmitted generationally through culture and values and things like that. So cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, so one of the, I think one of the tragedies of addiction, if you think about it, if a child is born with a genetic vulnerability, that means there's a very high likelihood that one or both parents also got caught up in that vortex, in that web, which means there's a good chance that their childhood was characterized by one or both parents not being very good parents in some important ways. They might have been unavailable because they were living for their addiction and not for their child. They might have been erratic. They might have been abusive. There might be trauma. There might be neglect. Well, guess what? Childhood neglect, childhood abuse, childhood trauma, all of those things change our D2 receptor levels. All of those things cause D2 receptors to disappear, at least for a time. And so the genes can actually have an indirect effect as the parents carrying those genes get caught in their own addiction. They then mistreat their child in such a way that the child winds up even more vulnerable than they would have been just on the basis of the genes alone. Conversely, and here's the happy part of the story, the upward spiral you're talking about. If you have a parent who might be genetically vulnerable to addiction, but they manage to escape that vortex and they set in place all the things that we know that can change the brain for the better and make us more resilient and make us less addiction prone, they are going to be the kind of parents that give the kids the kind of childhood that will make them far, far, far more resilient and non-vulnerable to addiction.
Oh, man. Oh, I love that. And I really want to get there. Is there anything else we need to cover before we get into treatments and things we can do to kind of build that resilience in our own lives and the lives of the people that we care about?
Yeah, I think the one other thing we probably should talk about is the fact that if we use a drug that is very good at lighting up the reward circuits in the brain, then our D2 receptors are going to disappear. not completely, but they're going to downregulate. They're going to be thinner on the ground. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, well, wait a minute, Steve, you said that you're a pathetic caffeine junkie. So like, are you not getting high on life? And the answer is caffeine, it turns out, is not particularly good at lighting up the reward circuits. It can do it a little bit, but nothing like, say, heroin, nothing like cocaine, nothing like alcohol. And so, all these things need to be, I think, dealt with some nuance. There can be something that, yeah, in theory, potentially there's some addictive potential, but like if we're using a drug that really lights up the reward circuits, then we have to know it's going to make us more vulnerable to other forms of addiction. Now, I'm going to say something that some of our audience are not going to want to hear, but I think it's really important to put out there. There is a very common class of anxiety medications that have been extraordinarily popular during the pandemic and even before. We call them benzos or benzodiazepines. They are among the most widely prescribed medications in all of psychiatry. So what are we talking about? Drugs like Xanax, drugs like Ativan and Valium and Klonopin and others. And they have generic names that usually end in ZAM, like Alprazolam, Lorazepam, etc. These drugs are addictive, potentially. They light up the brain's reward circuits really powerfully. They have a withdrawal syndrome after chronic use, and that can be even as short as a couple months. By the way, I'm not giving medical advice. Talk to your own healthcare provider, but just make sure that you know that when using one of these drugs every day, there is the possibility that D2 receptors could start to downregulate, start to disappear, so that we could not only be caught in the vortex of addiction to the Xanny. By the way, just, an aside, Does it seem like maybe a big hint to anyone that like a popular party drug, Xanny, might not be a great drug to be given out like candy to people who are presenting with mental health
I don't know.
Challenges?
That's a bit of a stretch, do you not think? I mean, there's some really smart people prescribing these drugs. I think we should just trust them.
I totally should just trust the doctors on this. Yeah. So anyway, the point is just that any drug, any substance that we use repeatedly will tend to dull our reward circuits. And I think that maybe that's a pivot into something you want to talk about with Dr. Anna Lemke.
Yeah, and that was like borderline prophetic what you just did, because I literally in my head, I was like, beep, beep, beep. How can I bring in Anna Lemke into this moment? Yeah, because you were talking about a couple of keywords that like triggered it for me. And if anyone hasn't checked it out, we did an amazing interview with Dr. Anna Lemke. She's one of the world's leading experts on dopamine. And she talked a lot about this idea of a seesaw and, you know, dopamine being on one side, pleasure and kind of pain or effort being on the other. And she talked a lot about upregulation and downregulation. She talked about a thing called a dopamine fast. And basically her working thesis is that whenever you restrict the things that really spike your dopamine and light up your reward pass in a really intense way, as Steve was saying, your body reprograms itself, your brain changes to make you more sensitive to everyday pleasure. And I found, like, over the last, call it 3 to 5 years, that by turning down some of these spikes, whether it's in the food that I eat or even some of the behaviors that I engage in, I found it a lot easier to stay in that kind of middle path, that middle ground that a lot of us are kind of searching for. But I've also found myself having way better impulse control and less cravings and just less susceptible to any form of addictive behavior, whether it is something that you ingest or a behavior that you kind of take part in. So I guess that's all I kind of say at this point. If that is ringing any of your bells or getting you excited, I encourage you to go back and check out the full thing.
Yeah, no, you're talking to our audience. I'm like, yes, it's ringing bells. It's getting me excited. Yes. So I love that you brought up impulse control, because it's really the last thing I just wanted to say about like what makes us vulnerable to addiction. It's a really critically important personality variable, individual difference in terms of like how impulsive are we, how much willpower do we have, how much ability to delay gratification. Now, I got to be careful because I'm not saying that addiction all comes down to having no willpower.
Yeah.
It's not that at all. But think about the front end of addiction. When a person, they have a sort of moment of like, oh my God, this substance, this behavior could take over my life if I don't nip it in the bud right now. Mm. It's like, okay, you know, terribly hackneyed, overused metaphor, but like the snowball at the top of the hill, tiny little snowball, you start pushing it down the hill. And if you can stop it in the first, let's say, you know, 20 meters or so, it's still small enough. It might be getting, you know, some momentum, but you could still stop it. But you can also look at it and know, like, if I don't stop it right now, I'm doomed. It is going to be massive. It's going to, you know, go all the way to the bottom of the hill, and there's no stopping it. So example from my own life, and I don't think I've shared this in our pod. I've told you about it just in our friendship. My parents both dabbled with smoking when I was little. And this is back in a time when nobody really gave that much thought. I mean, yeah, people knew cigarettes were bad. They kind of suspected maybe secondhand smoke is not great for kids, but like there were no really overwhelmingly compelling studies or public health messaging. So long story short, as a little kid, I spent many, many, many long car rides basically in this little automobile cabin with my parents smoking. And you can imagine the level of nicotine and other tobacconoids that I'm inhaling while my brain is wiring itself up. And it didn't go on for that long, but it was enough that I, to this day, am a sucker for nicotine. Yeah, and bro, it does turn out that, you know, everybody's brain is a little different in terms of which drug is better at hacking than others. My kryptonite is tobacco. And I have only in my life probably smoked fewer than 20 cigarettes. But every time I did, it was that sensation of like, this is like coming home.
Mm.
This, I mean, not in the dramatic way that, say, you know, a hardcore heroin addict might describe their first time getting high, but just this feeling of like, I like this way too much.
Yeah.
And so I had enough self-awareness and enough ability to leverage circuits in the prefrontal cortex that we all have that are basically like, huh, I'm going to evaluate this impulse and I'm going to slam on the brakes if I think it's stupid. It's like, it's the circuits that let us bite our tongue rather than say something really damaging in a relationship, or, you know, saying something to that waiter who's having a bad day and they messed up our order, you know, and we're just like, no, I'm going to be kind. Or not, right? If we're really sleep deprived and our prefrontal circuits are not working very well, we might be more impulsive and say something we'd regret. Well, anyway, those of us who are blessed with reasonably good impulse control often are able to leverage it very early on in the addictive process to slam the brakes on something before it spirals out of control. That's the only chance we have, by the way. Once it's taken us over, nobody has enough willpower to make it stop.
That's right. That's where like willpower just doesn't work anymore.
Exactly.
Also, 20 meters? Like, am I rubbing off on you? You just give a metric?
Measurement? You know,
I was like, yeah, dude, did he do that for my benefit or was it accidental?
Well, I figured, you know, with your very classy Irish accent, we might end up with some of our audience in the UK and Ireland. I lived in the UK for 3 years as a young man.
It's all coming out now.
It's all coming back. Yeah. You know, pretty soon. You know what? I was gonna show off, and I was like, oh, I got nothing. I was gonna show off some great British slang. It's like, I got nothing. It's gone. I think it would come back though. Eventually.
You know, but it's interesting. You know, with your cigarette analogy, like this is a made up scenario, but like in some ways, you could have been 10 more cigarettes away from a lifelong habit. You know, it's just interesting
how even
like luck and the environment you're in at the time, like all these things can kind of come into play and can tip you on the very, very thin line between this is something I walk away from and this is something that engulfs me. It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. The only other thing I'd say about that is that those of us who are blessed with better impulse regulatory circuitry in the prefrontal cortex, if we find ourselves addicted, we will usually have one or more moments of clarity, epiphanies, where we're like, holy crap, I'm destroying my life, my health, my, you know, whatever. And we might then be able to still leverage that semblance of willpower that we have to get into like a rehab program or some form of treatment that's going to be enough to extricate us, even if we can't extricate ourselves. We might still be able to have enough insight to get to the help that we need.
Incredible stuff. Hello, this is Hugh from the future here in the editing room. And I think this is probably just as good as any place to wrap up for today. As you probably guessed from the title of this episode, we will be releasing part 2 next week on Monday morning. So be sure to subscribe and hit the bell on your favorite podcast app, as the cool kids like to say, so you don't miss out on all the good stuff, mainly Steve, but also sometimes myself, have to say. As always, you can expect plenty of practical tools and practices to come. But until then, I just really want to say thank you so much for being here. We'd really appreciate you sharing this podcast with the people you care about the most, or dropping us a wee note to say hello by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Honest feedback is welcome. We make this show for you. We want to make this show better. And so any way you can help us do that, we would be all ears to hear from you and make that happen. Would also like to mention that this is a crowdfunded show, which means that we rely on the generosity of listeners just like you who want to join us on our journey and our mission of providing free educational content around the theme of mental health for people all over the world without having to sell our souls or compromise our content to the gods of advertising or sponsorship. So look, if the podcast has benefited you in any sort of way and you've the means to pledge the price of a, I don't know, hipster cup of coffee each month, I'd love to invite you to our private community over at patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast, where you can also get access
to exclusive content, early releases of episodes, including the full version of today's episode. Right now, it's sitting over there on the Patreon, and also the chance to connect with us and each other in a more intimate way. There's also our website, mentalhealth.fm, which is where you can submit a question for our upcoming Q&A episode, as well as checking out the show notes for links to everything we covered in this week's episode. Thanks so much again for being here, and as the good professor often says, peace out and stay well until next time. Cheers.